This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, big news. The Dow hit 30,000 today, and you know what that means. It means the Dow hit 30,000, y'all. Come on. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Tuesday, today the 24th day of November. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Those nice round milestones that people think carry some mystical message about the stock market and the health of this economy. Number one, cut it out. 30,000 is just a number. Number two, stock market, economy, not. And number three, there is a lot that goes into the rally these markets have been having these past 6 or 8 months. One of those things, stocks are one of the only reliable places to get a return on your money over time right now. And you know why that is? That is, at least in part, because interest rates are and are going to stay, if you listen closely to what Fed Chair Jay Powell says, rates are going to stay really, really low for as long as it takes to get this economy back firing on all cylinders. So what does it look like, do you suppose, when rates are as low as they are for as long as they are going to be low? Marketplace's Sabri Benishore gets us going.
When interest rates are low, it's a helpful thing. It's good. Seth Carpenter is chief U.S. economist with UBS.
You make it cheaper for businesses and households to borrow so that they can either invest or hire or spend.
Now, of course, the reason rates are low is bad. The Fed has had to lower them to help businesses stay in business and consumers keep spending during the pandemic. But even though lots of firms would like to take advantage of low rates, a lot of them are afraid to because of uncertainty. Lee Brandstetter is professor of economics and public policy at Carnegie Mellon.
The cost of debt-financed investment is very low. But on the other hand, you don't quite know when the world is going to go back to normal.
So the economy is in this kind of sad place. The Fed can't do a whole lot more. The only thing really left is for Congress and a president to pass more stimulus. That would mean more debt. Peter Ireland is professor of economics at Boston College.
The deficit to GDP ratio, we're told, is higher today than it's been since World War II.
But if the country does need to go into more debt, now would be a good time, precisely because rates are so low. Again, UBS's Seth Carpenter.
At least for as long as rates stay as low as they are, it makes it easier, more affordable to carry around a larger debt burden.
But if the Biden administration faces a split Congress, the chances of much more stimulus fall. Carpenter says the last time this happened, after the Great Recession, a bickering Congress that couldn't pass enough stimulus actually slowed down the recovery. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
The public health crisis that the Biden administration is going to inherit is about to turn into a housing crisis, too, with millions of people potentially facing eviction and foreclosure next year as a federal moratorium ends. We don't know yet who the president-elect is going to pick, but whoever is named to head the Department of Housing and Urban Development, it is likely the federal government's going to be taking a bigger role in promoting affordable housing. Marketplace's Amy Scott has more on what that might look like.
One thing this pandemic has revealed is just how critical housing is.
As people are now like working from home, schooling from home, you know, healing from home.
And Elena McCargo with the Urban Institute says helping people stay in their homes will be at the top of the list for a new housing secretary.
The number one priority is going to be the response to this pandemic and the health crisis that has now also become a housing crisis.
But beyond the pandemic, the incoming administration will still face a deeper affordability crisis, and there's only so much it can do. Expanding housing assistance for low-income people would need Congress to act, and many of the barriers to building affordable housing are local. Edward Goetz teaches urban planning at the University of Minnesota. He expects the Biden administration to take on what's called exclusionary zoning, building rules that only allow single-family homes in certain areas, or large lot sizes.
And when you do that, then you essentially ensure that it's really quite difficult to build housing that is affordable to lower income households.
Goetz says a Biden HUD could dangle incentives like federal grants tied to less restrictive zoning. Emily Hamilton researches housing policy at George Mason University's Mercatus Center.
The problem is that the most exclusionary jurisdictions tend to also be very high income jurisdictions where these federal grants may mean less.
Congress may find some common ground. Earlier this year, the House approved the bipartisan Yes in My Backyard Act, which would encourage local governments to lift barriers to construction. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
This is like opposite world to Amy's story, but in non-affordable housing news, the benchmark Case-Shiller Home Price Index came out this morning. To give full credit, actually, it is technically called the S&P CoreLogic Case-Shiller U.S. National Home Price Index. Anyway, it's a big bump. Home prices rose 7% in September from a year earlier, the biggest jump in 6 years. Lots of data coming tomorrow of a holiday-shortened week, by the by. First-time claims for unemployment, which has become a regular Thursday barometer since the pandemic started, will come out in the morning, as will an update to third-quarter economic growth and that all-important number on consumer spending as well. On Wall Street today, as I said, the Dow hit a number, NASDAQ hit a number, the S&P hit a number. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Depending on where you are in this country, there are shutdowns or curfews or limits of one kind or another on what businesses are being allowed to do as we look at rising case counts from here through the end of the year, maybe longer, who knows. The first time businesses went through this back in March and April, they had federal relief to fall back on. Not as we've been reporting this time. So as Marketplace's Justin Ho reports, some restaurants are trying to plan how to cope.
It's been 8 months since Nico Freccia first shut down indoor dining at his taproom. He's the co-founder of 21st Amendment Brewery in the Bay Area. And ever since, he and his staff have been working to make the indoor space safer.
We spent a lot of time and money building partitions, getting air circulation, getting the right cleaning protocols in place and training.
A couple of weeks ago, the taproom finally reopened for indoor dining. But COVID cases in the Bay Area have been rising. And last week, the county shut down indoor dining.
So we had exactly 1 week of indoor dining, and we were full every night.
Freccia says the taproom still has outdoor dining, and the company sells a lot of beer to grocery stores. But he says other restaurants won't be as lucky as restrictions ramp up.
It just seems clear, especially with the rollbacks that are happening all over the country due to the increase in COVID cases, that there needs to be an additional aid program.
Like another round of the Paycheck Protection Program that kept a lot of businesses afloat earlier in the pandemic. Without something like that, the outlook is bleak for some restaurants. Bobby Jones is the chef and co-owner of The Point, a crab house on the Chesapeake Bay in Maryland. Last Friday, his county cut indoor dining capacity in half to 25%, and so...
Right now, we're basically shedding cash because we don't want to lay off all our employees.
But he says he and his wife Julie, his co-owner, had no choice but to let some workers go.
Yeah, I think, how many did we lay off today, Joe? 30?
Between both places.
Yeah, 30 people today.
Julie Jones says it's harder to lay people off now than it was earlier in the year, when workers could fall back on a $600 a week federal top-up to state unemployment benefits.
You know, I'm worried now because that $600 isn't there. And, you know, it's not an easy decision to make of who you keep and who you have to lay off first and in what order they go.
Without any new relief aid in the pipeline, some restaurant owners are revamping their business models in an effort to survive. Kevin Takarada runs Maki Maki, a sushi restaurant in Midtown Manhattan. 2 weeks ago, he added shabu shabu to his menu. That's a type of Japanese hot pot that also helps keep customers warm inside the restaurant's outdoor tents.
People are not going to, you know, sit in 30, 40 degree weather outside just because it's covered in plastic and eat a sushi roll. I just don't think that market exists.
Takarada says the Midtown office workers his restaurant normally serves have started to return. But he's worried about what might happen now that New York City schools are closed again.
Parents can't leave to go to work anymore. They have to go back to remote working.
Takarada says he's hoping for another round of Paycheck Protection Program money, but he knows he can't depend on it. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Five words, everybody, for your listening pleasure. David Brancaccio, Marketplace Morning Report. Check it out. With or without a pandemic, these days leading up to Thanksgiving are some of the busiest at American grocery stores. Shoppers in various states of panic rushing through with carts full of potatoes and pumpkin and cranberries. Fresh in my house, thank you very much. None of that gelatinous canned stuff. Also, that essential ingredient, garlic. As it happens, we know a guy in the garlic business. His name is Ken Christopher. He is the executive vice president of the family business. It's called Christopher Ranch. They are in Gilroy, California. Mr. Christopher, welcome to the program, sir.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
What's the current state of the American garlic business?
The American garlic industry is in a very unique state right now. We're seeing a surge of demand nationwide for garlic, unlike we've seen in company history. My family's been farming garlic since 1956, so you can imagine we know what we're talking about when it comes to garlic. And we're seeing shipments approaching 50, 60, 70% over the same time last year.
Why do you think that is?
So I think nationwide, we're seeing a lot more states starting to enforce restrictive orders. You can imagine with cold, with rain, with snow, more and more families are going to select to go to their local grocery stores, maybe instead of going out to restaurants. And so as that happens, there's a natural increase in demand for fresh garlic nationwide.
Does that imply that the garlic I buy at the supermarket is different than the garlic that my local restaurant would buy?
That's exactly right. So restaurants nationwide are going to purchase pre-peeled garlic. You know, back before 2020, before COVID, our sales were approximately half fresh garlic for retailers and about half was peeled garlic for restaurants. And we've seen a huge decline on the peeled side, but a massive surge on the fresh side. And we're just trying to adapt the best we can to handle supply chains nationwide.
Let me ask you big picture supply chain stuff. Give me the current state of tariffs, would you, on garlic? Because that was a big thing for your industry back 18 months ago.
So back in the 1990s, my grandfather actually was the first one to petition the U.S. government to enact an almost, I think it's a 400% tariff on inbound Chinese garlic that has proven to be violating U.S. law. And then myself, I went out to Washington in 2018 to offer testimony to enact a fresh 25% tariff on top of what my grandfather did back in the 90s in order to try to stop Chinese garlic from entering our country. Before COVID, the existential threat to our company and to all U.S. garlic growers was Chinese garlic being illegally dumped on our shores. Since COVID, that threat has somewhat diminished because demand has grown so enormously. Mm-hmm. So it's a unique place we're finding yourself in.
So you're pro-tariff, but demand is helping you out just in terms of those margins and stuff.
Exactly, yes.
Yeah. What do you suppose your industry looks like once we can all go back out to restaurants and there's a change of administration and who knows what tariff policy is going to be? What's your short to medium term future?
It's looking encouraging because one of the other great threats beyond Chinese garlic has been comprehensive immigration policy. You know, the Trump administration wasn't exactly immigration friendly. And as farmers, we rely on that critical pool of talent to get all the work that needs to be done. And so we're looking forward to a Joe Biden administration working with Congress to finally get something going.
Do you use a lot of garlic when you cook? Is that a thing you do?
I do use a lot of garlic when I cook. You know, if I'm, you know, looking at a recipe and it calls for 2 to 3 cloves, I'm going to double that. I'm going to quadruple that every single time. You know, my family has been a part of the garlic capital of the world here in Gilroy, California for decades. And so garlic is a critical part of who we are.
Oh, I know. You drive through it, you can smell it. Ken Christopher, he's the executive VP of Christopher Ranch up in Gilroy, talking his own book on garlic in this economy. Mr. Christopher, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Coming up,
I'm a glass half empty kind of guy.
Get ready for your daily dose of pessimism, I guess. But first, let's do the numbers. I don't know if I have the incredibly happy music slated for today, but I don't get to pick. Anyway, Dow Industrial is up 454, 1.5%, closed at 30,046, or 30,046. NASDAQ up 156 points, 1.3%, 12,036. The S&P 500 lifted 57 points, 1.6%, 36.35. There are a 12-ounce bottle of Cholula Original Hot Sauce. We'll run you about $5. If you want to buy a whole lot of sauce, like all of it, the price tag for the brand is $800 million. But spice maker McCormick beat you to it. Sorry. McCormick added 1.9% today. But have you got anything without Spam in it? Spam maker Hormel Foods sliced off 5.7% today after missing on earnings and revenue. By the way, some of the things you can make with Spam include egg and Spam, egg bacon and Spam, egg bacon sausage and Spam, Spam bacon sausage and Spam, Spam egg Spam, Spam bacon and Spam. You're listening to Marketplace.
Now. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns, meaning when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal, rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Palo Alto Networks. As you innovate to transform your business in today's digital world, how do you stay secure? At Palo Alto Networks, our mission is to protect your digital way of life. Whether it's unprecedented opportunities or uncertainties with AI and whatever comes next, we continually deliver innovation to make each day safer and more secure than the one before. More at paloaltonetworks.com.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million-dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Among the industries you could quite reasonably have predicted would suffer in this pandemic, you got to list online dating. I mean, strangers, meeting in person, even with masks, and especially now with infection counts rising. Oh, but as Marketplace's Jasmine Garst reports, the heart wants what the heart wants.
38-year-old Jen Fils started doing the online dating thing for the first time in March as Milwaukee locked down.
I'm a very social person, and so it was really hard for me to suddenly go from going out and talking to random people to having absolutely no interaction with anyone.
Fils has joined Hinge, Tinder, Bumble, and Facebook dating. She's part of a trend. Dating app usage is growing during the pandemic. According to data company Apptopia, the top 20 apps have gained 1.5 million daily active users this year. Jonathan Kay is the founder of Apptopia. He says it's not just the big brand names in online dating that are growing.
We're starting to see like a bunch of niche dating apps pop up as well, which I think are actually taking some market share away from larger players.
Apps like BLK for Black singles and Chispa for Latinx people. It is, of course, that time of year known as cuffing season, you know, when you want to be tied to one person because it's getting colder, the holidays are approaching, and your nosy aunt is definitely going to ask if you're dating someone. But analyst Ali Mogarabi at Morningstar says it's not just that.
You've got singles sitting at home wanting that interaction. A lot of them basically began using online dating apps even more.
There are also signs hookup culture could be waning in the era of COVID-19, with infection a constant concern. Jen Fils of Milwaukee says she's definitely noticed.
There is a lot more like, hey, let's try to like Zoom date or whatever else before we actually meet.
Right now, her dates are exclusively on Zoom. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
However long this recovery takes, the economy we are going to have when the pandemic is done is not going to be the economy we had going in. And while predictions are always tricky, if you look at some of the trends from the before times, you can get a sense of what the after times, to coin a phrase, might be like. That's what Scott Galloway did. He teaches at the Stern School of Business at NYU, and he takes on the post-corona economy in his new book. Scott, it's good to have you on.
Thanks, Scott. Good to be with you.
So I don't know when the last time your name was paired with Jay Powell's in question, but if never before, then it's happening now. He gave a set of remarks the other day, the Fed chair did, talking about how we were going to recover into a different economy, right, into a different future, which seems to me to be sort of the through line of this book, Post-Corona, From Crisis to Opportunity. What is your thumbnail sketch of the future into which this economy is recovering?
Well, COVID-19 is really more of an accelerant than a change agent. Take any two or three trends in any industry and take them out where they were supposed to be in 10 years and ask yourself, are we there now? In many of the cases, you say, yeah, we're already there.
One of the examples that's early on in this book, and it's a no-brainer, right, given that we're all getting Amazon and e-commerce deliveries all the time, is e-commerce penetrations. In the last, 8 weeks or something before April, it just skyrocketed, as you point out in the graph in this book.
Examples everywhere. 2000 is when e-commerce started really registering purchase, and loosely speaking, it grew 1% a year. That is, every year, another 1% of total retail went through digital channels. And sitting here in March of 2020, we were at 18%, and within 8 weeks, we went to 28%. So we had a decade of e-commerce growth. So across every industry, it's not that the trends really look much different. They've just absolutely accelerated.
So here comes the subjective question that goes with that data. Is that a good thing or a meh thing?
Yeah, I think the answer is yes. It depends on which side of the future. Look, if you're part of the cable bundle, it's a bad thing because what was once a great industry with affiliate fees is now declining faster. If you were in the cloud-based business and you were growing your business 20% a year, you're going to grow 30%. So if you're on the right side, if things were going well, then things are going really well. And if you're in an industry that was flat to declining, it seems as if your death has been moved up. So it's entirely situational.
We weren't ready for this because nobody can be ready for a pandemic. Are we adjusting mid-course? Are we making the right corrections?
Gosh, that's a tough question. I would argue as, well, okay, so for example, let's say government. Government is now spending what it was projected to spend in 2044. We've accelerated government spend by 24 mm-hmm. years. Now, ideally, that's cyclical, that'll go back. But the question becomes, if we were trying to get out of this crisis, did the money get to the right places? And I would argue that with savings rates at all times highs, and what seems to be an obsession with keeping restaurants open, despite the fact that schools are closed, if you look at the net wealth of the wealthiest 10% skyrocketing, you might argue that all we've done is we've just taken this existing trend of income inequality and turned a dysfunctional economy into a dystopian one.
That's a little bleak, man, in a bleak time.
Well, God, we know each other well enough. I'm a glass half empty kind of guy. But look, there's a silver lining here as big as the cloud. If this is an opportunity for a younger generation to observe the importance of cooperation, the importance of funding our institutions. You know, a crisis is a terrible thing to waste. Let's hope we don't waste it. Let's hope there's not too much structural damage from what I think will go down, at least from a government standpoint, I think we probably come in last. We had more time to prepare for this. We have the largest economy. We spend more money on healthcare, and it just hasn't – there's just nothing to be proud of here, at least along that line.
Well, let me get you back to where we started on the way out, and that is Jay Powell. One of the things he always says is we are doing what we're doing at the Fed to avoid long-term damage to this economy. As we sit here in late November-ish of this pandemic year, with Congress literally not meeting on fixing this economy, do you think we avoid long-term damage?
I think there's a lot of unnecessary damage, and I think it all comes down to the crucial mistake. I think the majority of our efforts around COVID-19, the majority of the stimulus was this notion that we need to protect companies, whereas I believe we should have been protecting people. And it's not a supply problem in our economy. It's a demand problem. And I think we would have been much better off in terms of velocity, in terms of recirculation of those stimulus dollars had we put them in the hands of the people that needed them. You put $10,000 worth of stimulus in the hands of households that are struggling and they spend it all. You give a small business owner $1 million in terms of a bailout. Some of it goes into the business. I would argue most of it goes into the market. If you have the market higher than it's ever been, but a third of America can't make the rent and there's food insecurity, I would argue that this just didn't work. We need to protect people, not companies.
Scott Galloway teaches at Stern at NYU, writes a bunch of stuff, most recently a book called Post-Corona, From Crisis to Opportunity. Scott, thanks a lot. Good to talk to you as always.
Yeah, likewise. Thanks, Kai.
This final note on the way out today, which comes with the observation that because I've got some home internet issues, I've been coming downtown to the Marketplace Studios for a couple of months now to get the show on the air. And honestly, traffic, while lighter, has not been as light as I might have expected. And that gets me to this. A story in Reuters the other day based on Federal Highway Administration data. We drove 8.6 fewer miles in September this year than we did in September a year ago. Now, for some context, in April, road traffic was down almost 40% year on year. All right, we got to go. But first, your Tuesday in a short week moment of economic context. And I apologize in advance for going out on a downbeat note. But since we started with Dow 30K, the rules of business and economic journalism require that I end with the actual economy. The chosen metric, my go-to in most cases, is jobs. So I will note in advance of the official report tomorrow morning that something near 20 million people in this economy are getting some kind of unemployment benefit from the government. Our digital and on-demand team is Carrie Barber, Samantha Fields, Ben Hethcote, Sarah Menendez, Eliza Mills, and Janet Wynn. Star Nieves, executive directs our on-demand staff. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too.
Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.